From the Moen Broadcast Center at KPCC, this is The Frame. I'm John Horn. On today's show, Julia Louis-Dreyfus, the star of Veep, talks about creating political satire that makes both liberals and conservatives laugh at themselves and each other.
I had the great good fortune to meet Supreme Court Justice Elena Kagan, and she told me she got together with Justice Scalia every week to discuss the past week's episode because they were both fans. Imagine that.
And why are so many movies and TV shows being turned into live stage shows? Are you ready for The Empire Strips Back? All that coming up on The Frame. Welcome to The Frame. I'm John Horn. Emmy-winning actress and comedian Julia Louis-Dreyfus entertained audiences for 6 years as the eternal presidential hopeful Selina Meyer on HBO's Veep. The series recently launched its seventh and final season. Meyer's political antics leave audiences on both sides of the aisle laughing, and the extremes that her character displays in chasing the presidency raises the obvious question, does art imitate life or the other way around? Louis-Dreyfus made a name for herself in the 1980s, fighting the boys' club culture on Saturday Night Live. She went on to create the iconic Elaine Benes on Seinfeld. And while some careers can fizzle after that kind of success, Louis-Dreyfus came out swinging with the series The New Adventures of Old Christine. Louis-Dreyfus battled cancer while starring in Veep and soon after won the prestigious Mark Twain Award for humor. When I recently sat down with Louis-Dreyfus, she began by telling me what it's been like to film Veep's final season.
There's a lot of grief around the end of a series, assuming the series has been a good thing and a happy thing, which in our case it has been. That has an incredible bittersweetness to it that can really gut you. And it did. It did. Saying goodbye to this show, and those who watch it will see that the finale is a gut-wrencher.
There'll be tears. There'll be lots of crying amidst some of the laughter. Let's talk about the final season. Selena's running for president, and she is asked a basic question very early in this season, which is why. And other people are curious, but here's a conversation that she has with Gary, who's played by Tony Hale.
For 3 years, Hughes kept me chained to a radiator in some basement in Cleveland. So as far as I'm concerned, America owes me an 8-year stay in the White House, and this time I want a war.
Yes.
All right. Do you mean to read that back?
No, we can't use any of that.
What is it like listening to that?
It's gobs of fun. I think that's so well written. So I was just sort of listening to the language. And, you know, she's not a great candidate.
That's an understatement.
But I appreciate her bitterness and her struggle.
When you are playing her, do you have some way of saying, okay, I know that this is a character, and I know that what she wants is not something that she's able to express, but as the actor playing her, I have to believe what it is she wants, and are you able to articulate what it is she wants, even as a fictional character?
Well, here's how I would answer that. She's a very horrible human being, and hideously behaved, and really has no leadership skills whatsoever, or no point of view even, other than her own narcissistic endeavor. But when you play her, you have to come at it from, well, why? And once you start to humanize that horribleness, you can find a way in to play it with a certain amount of, well, in a weird way, I have to say empathy.
Right.
And even though I'm not necessarily asking the viewer to be empathetic, I just want the viewer to laugh. But perhaps that keeps her from being hated by the audience.
Right. The other thing that's amazing about that clip is if you were to put some sort of like those clickers that they do when you go into a state fair, insults per second, the amount of creative language that's put in dialogue in the show is, I don't think it has a peer. I mean, what David Mamet was doing 20 years on stage, this is David Mamet on steroids in terms of the way that the writers are able to use language and the creative expressions of insults that they're able to do. And I'm wondering what that process is like as an actor and as a collaborator about text and about dialogue and about how rich the language is in the show.
Well, I would say that tone and that density has only gotten denser. And it's like it's been steeped longer. You know what I mean?
Yes.
So there's no air. We take all the air out in the edit. I will tell you that these episodes are much longer when they're first put together. So a half hour script is normally, I want to say, 45 pages max. Our length of show is usually about 60, 65 pages. And
is that up from when it started, that you're fitting more into a shorter period of time, or?
That's sort of always been the case, but I would say it's even more the case now.
Okay.
And so when the edit first comes in, the challenge is reduction, because, I mean, even sometimes it's been over an hour. And we have to take it down to 30 minutes. Therefore, the language gets, those insults become, they sort of go on top of each other like a huge fat hoagie.
As you watch the show, you say to yourself, wait, what did she just say 3 seconds ago? That you're always kind of, in some ways, and I think this is a, sounds like a backhanded compliment, but it's a compliment, that you can't even tally how horrible the language and the insults are because it happens so fast.
Yeah, I know. I mean, that's true. For instance, if we even screen it for an audience, which we've done on occasion at premieres and so on, the audience misses half of it because they're laughing over something and two things fly by underneath the laugh. You know, that's just the structure of the show. It's what I like about the show. I think it gives it some staying power.
I want to talk about another thing. In Park City at the Sundance Film Festival a couple months ago, we were talking with Julia Sweeney about being on Saturday Night Live.
It was just all the guys. There were more women portrayed on SNL that season in drag by like Chris Farley and David Spade than there were actual women. Like, they were literally only 3 women and 10 guys, and then we couldn't even get parts because the guys were in drag.
The most frustrating thing for me was that I really didn't get any material to do, to speak of. You know, it was very hard for me to get myself on air, you know, unless I was playing like a nurse or the receptionist or the whatever, you know, I mean. But I'm going to say that I did learn from that experience a lot. So I'm not advocating for that kind of hardship,
right,
but I did take something out of it.
Coming up, more with Julia Louis-Dreyfus and the last season of her HBO series, Veep. Welcome back to The Frame. I'm John Horn. We're talking with Emmy Award-winning comedic actress Julia Louis-Dreyfus. She stars as Selina Meyer in the HBO series Veep, which is now in its 7th and final season. We pick up our conversation with Louis-Dreyfus explaining how the cast pulls off Veep's trademark high-speed, insult-packed dialogue.
It means you have to come to set knowing the material well. And very often you may improvise around a line and then certain things get locked in. But I will say that there's a great deal of attention paid to making things sound authentic. So I like to call it zhuzhing it, sort of taking a line and I don't know how to say this other than zhuzh, making it, mushing it up in a way so that it feels more natural and not necessarily written. And I mean that when I say that, it's not an insult to our writers at all, but I think they would know what I mean when I say that, or I know that they do. We all sort of strive to make it seem, yes, it's very written. Yes, the insults are intense and beautiful, but you want them to have an authenticity that comes from rehearsal and this sort of zhuzh thing.
In comedy, a lot of people would agree, stand-ups would say, you can make jokes about Nazis, but you can't make jokes about the Holocaust. That there is like a line that sometimes you can't cross in stand-up.
Hmm.
Some people believe that.
Yeah.
Is there a line that you can't cross on Veep, or have you crossed it so many times that line no longer exists in terms of what you can say about somebody else?
Yeah, I think there probably is a line, and we don't cross it. But I can't identify to you what it is. I just tell you what my sensibility is about certain things. You know, for instance, in this season, we're tackling, and we tackled it before in previous seasons, gun control. And it's pretty hardcore, but I like the way we do it. It's satire.
Right.
And I think that's really needs to be satirized.
And any satire, good satire, is dealing with what's actually true. and making some loosely fictionalized version of what it is that's true. And in this season, you're talking about thoughts and prayers for gun victims.
And we hopefully do it in a way that's very, very funny. And if there's a poignancy to it, fabulous.
When you think about how absurd so many things are, does it make it more difficult to satirize things because what is happening in truth may be stranger than what's happening in fiction?
It does make it more difficult. I will not lie. This past year in particular, this final season, was a challenge. Given our current political climate, much more difficult to do because I would say the Trump White House might even be writing a better episode of Veep, except it ain't funny, right? So that said, I think our show reflects that this season. I think our show is more extreme. It's more out there. The episodes we're doing this season, never, they would have been an outrage 4 seasons ago, an outrage. It would have been like we'd gone off the rails completely.
I remember having a conversation a couple years ago with Bo Willimon when he was running House of Cards. It's a huge hit, and Bo is very politically active. And I said, Bo, why do you not use this platform? You have this huge audience, and yet your show is somewhat apolitical. And he said, well, that's not what the show's about. It's a palace intrigue show. It's about betrayals. It's, you know, about this. I go, but you could sneak that stuff in. And we had a very animated conversation. He goes, I don't think that's the place for this show. So when you're thinking about the balance between making an entertaining, funny comedy and actually having something to say that might make people think about an issue in a new way, how do you figure out where that line is, what the balance is, and that you have an audience and that you should maybe prick up their ears here and there?
Right. That's not the agenda going in.
Right?
The agenda going in is talking about the culture of politics. But in so doing, you are going to be dealing with issues like gun control, abortion rights, racism. We tackle Me Too this season. Certain areas are unavoidable and they're kind of ripe for the taking. I mean, let's put it this way. I know that in doing the research for this show, and we've had access to meeting a lot of people in Washington on both sides of the aisle, and both sides of the aisle are fans of the show. So I think that's interesting. I hear time and time again, this is what it's really like in Washington. And, you know, I wince as I say that to you. But yeah, that's what we hear. We really do. I'm not kidding. I remember, by the way, that I had the great good fortune to meet Supreme Court Justice Elena Kagan once. And she told me that she got together with Justice Scalia when Veep was on the air every week to discuss the past week's episode, because they were both fans. Imagine that.
I can't.
I know. I would do anything to have heard those conversations.
Let's hope somebody recorded them.
I know. Maybe the FBI.
They might have. Who knows?
Fingers crossed.
We're talking with Julia Louis-Dreyfus about Veep. I want to talk about some other things. In 2015,
sure,
you were in a sketch on Inside Amy Schumer.
Oh, yeah.
Where Amy's hiking and comes across a beautiful picnic table. There's food and wine. Patricia Arquette and Tina Fey are celebrating something. Let's listen to a part of this short that Amy did.
In every actress's life, the media decides when you finally reach the point where you're not believably f***able anymore.
I mean, how do you know? Who tells you?
Well, nobody really overtly tells you, but there are signs. How Sally Field was Tom Hanks's love interest in Punchline, and then like 20 minutes later, she was his mom in Forrest Gump.
Or you might get offered a rom-com with Jack Nicholson where you're competing with another woman to f*** him. Or I just had an audition for Mrs. Claus.
You're kidding me.
I read for that part.
It was directed by Nicole Holofcener, who you did the movie Enough Said with, and like any good satire, a lot of truth there. I mean, the margin between what they're joking about and what is true is razor thin.
I know. I had this very sort of out-of-body experience shooting it. I was delighted to be a part of it. It was an amazing sketch. I love all those ladies very much. About halfway through the day shooting that, I started to have a panic attack internally. And I started to think, wait a minute, I don't think this is funny anymore. I don't get this. All of a sudden, it was like, hold on a second. Wait, is this funny? I'm not sure this is so funny. But anyway, it was funny and I was happy to do it. But yeah, that was a very well written, very high concept sketch that I think landed pretty well.
Do you think that panic attack was tied to the fact that it was something that people actually considered?
Oh, of course. Yeah, it's completely born out of truth. I mean, it's the truth.
I want to ask you about your cancer scare and about what that meant to you. It's obviously terrifying. You took a leave of absence. Obviously, you went through a lot of treatments.
Yeah.
You look great. I assume your health is good.
Yes.
But having gone through that, both personally and professionally, it's beyond my imagining. But how does it change you in terms of the way you look at work? I won't ask about your personal life, about your priorities, the things you're doing, or does it at all?
Well, I mean, it's going to sound so Pollyanna-ish, my answer, but coming back to work to try to make people laugh is a really good goal. During my treatment, we kept our writer's room open and we would have table reads every 3 weeks when I was sort of feeling up to it or stronger. And that was pretty buoying to me. The preciousness of life, and specifically my life and what I do in my life, came into crystal clear focus. You know, but it's also, needless to say, it's a terrifying thing to get that call. And that cliche of you don't think it's going to happen to you is infinitely true. And I'm still sort of, to be honest with you, I'm still kind of digesting everything that's happened. I don't have enough distance from it because I went back to work really quickly after my recovery and I've been working nonstop ever since. So I'm still kind of digesting this whole cancer romp.
If that's what it is.
Yeah.
Veep is going off the air. You have some other things that you're working on. What could you tell people about what might be in your future?
I just finished filming a movie in Austria for Fox Searchlight called Downhill, which is a remake of the Swedish film Force Majeure.
Oh, sure. This is about a couple and an avalanche and
yes.
How the husband, let's say, reacts to the avalanche that maybe reveals something about his marriage.
Correct.
Okay.
Right. So I worked on that for a number of months, and now I'm home. But that was interesting to be on the slopes and having a camera team on skis following you down a mountain. I mean, the whole thing was just incredible, but it was a gas and, you know, working on that now.
And what will you miss most about Veep?
My friends.
Yeah.
Yeah. I love those guys. And it was a perfect idea, in my view, executed perfectly by a whole group of people, an ensemble of writers and actors. And it was lightning in a bottle. I'm well aware of the fact that that thing doesn't come around all the time. So I miss the endeavor. I do miss linking arms with my friends to make the best possible thing we could do. And that's a lovely thing.
Julia, thanks so much.
Yeah, thank you so much.
Julia Louis-Dreyfus stars in Veep. New episodes air Sunday nights on HBO. Coming up on The Frame, how to get people off their couches, turn their favorite movies and TV series into live stage shows. Welcome back to The Frame. I'm John Horn. Have you noticed recently that a lot of new theater productions seem to be based on old movies and TV shows? Well, you're not alone. The Frame contributor Colin Friesen decided to find out why.
So ladies and gentlemen, give everything you've got in the way of applause for Luke Skywalker!
Tuesday night at the Wiltern Theater in Los Angeles, and the crowd for The Empire Strips Back, an Australian burlesque show, is more than ready for the dance numbers and suggested nudity to get started.
Star Wars, hell yes. Burlesque, hell yes. Put them together, oh yeah.
With sexified versions of Leia, Han, and Lady Stormtroopers in G-strings, it's a fun, racy night at the theater that answers the question you never knew you had. What would R2-D2 be like at a gentleman's club? It's all part of a growing live theater trend that mines movies and TV for source material. Right now on Broadway, for example, there's Beetlejuice, Mean Girls, King Kong, Pretty Woman, Tootsie. In Los Angeles, they're giving the cabaret treatment to Jurassic Park, 10 Things I Hate About You, even swinging with the music of Shrek. Russell Beatty is the creator of The Empire Strips Back. He says these days, to get people to leave their homes and get to the theater, you need a hook.
And we live in the age of nostalgia. Everyone kind of loves recycling the ideas from their youth at the moment.
Carly Lynn Serta, online at the Will Call window, agrees.
It's hard enough to get them into the movie theaters. So I completely agree. You have to do something crazy to get them in person, the butts in the seats.
Does this qualify?
Yeah.
Music theater nerds will now likely be pointing out examples of how pop culture feeding on itself is nothing new. Did you know Oklahoma, the musical, was based on the play Green Grow the Lilacs? And Cats was based on a bunch of poems about cats? Fair enough, but with so much competition out there for our attention, these days, theater producers at every level are hedging their bets even more by mounting shows with what they hope are a built-in fan base. Even critically acclaimed but now canceled TV shows are getting another life. Maeve Riley is one of the producers of the Crazy Ex-Girlfriend Cabaret that was performed at the Rockwell Table and Stage in Los Feliz. She says although she had star Rachel Bloom's blessing for the charity event, the corporate lawyers for Sony, which owns the show, still had to weigh in.
Any song we did was covered under the theater's performance license. And as long as we didn't do any dialogue from the television show or wear any replicas of the costumes, we were fine.
Beatty says his production is protected under law as a parody, but he has heard through back channels from Lucasfilm and Disney that there's nothing to worry about.
Yeah, they will never do a direct statement about us in that way, but, you know, the best thing is Disney understand fandom, and they understand that, you know, all this stuff kind of keeps the Star Wars fandom as crazy and ravenous as they are.
Other companies are also starting to recognize the publicity benefits of letting people play with their intellectual property.
It's a play about Game of Thrones.
It's about the TV show.
If you just read the books, fuck you. Spoilers.
There will be lots of...
That's a song from a parody Game of Thrones musical called Thrones, the Musical Parody. When Beatty and his team also put up a Game of Thrones parody called, wait for it, Dames of Thrones, because, you know, burlesque, it wasn't too long before they got a call from HBO. Turns out there were some elements in the show that violated trademark rules with corporate logos and whatnot. But after Beatty removed them, they were actually hired to perform at one of the Game of Thrones launch parties. So if all this is getting people to see live theater and no one is getting sued into bankruptcy, is there a downside? There is the argument that these so-called based-on productions crowd out more innovative original content. Beatty doesn't disagree, but says his shows are a means to an end.
For me, like, the Star Wars show allows me to do more original content. It allows me, it's my Trojan horse that gets me into the relationships, into the rooms, and it allows me to develop strategies and skill sets which smaller shows would never allow me to kind of do.
Johnny Pearl is another producer of the Crazy Ex-Girlfriend Cabaret. I asked him and Riley if it bothered them that original content is being squeezed out by adaptations and remakes.
Does it bother me? Yeah, it does a little. I'm
sitting in an audience watching the stage and everything I see is a remix of something that already exists, and it's almost an exact carbon copy of that. It's a little disappointing as an audience member that I keep getting the same stuff recycled. And I think we're still kind of stuck in that mega musical period where it's like not so much about the integrity of the writing, but it's like how many audience members can we get in?
It will continue in its own way, but they've got to run out of properties to adapt eventually. Yeah. And I think the audiences truthfully will get bored of this format.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, to be able to get that golden fabulousness here on this stage, we need to get a little bit of applause going. Give me something.
But will they? It does seem logical that even for an iconic series like Star Wars, you can only go to the well so often. Is a pants-free female Luke Skywalker soaping up a landspeeder, or a disturbingly thin Han Solo in his underwear licking his blaster a sign that we've got nowhere else to go? Judging by the audience reaction, I'm gonna say, I find your lack of faith disturbing. But, you know, in a sexy way. For The Frame, I'm Colin Friesen.
And that is it for today. Remember to follow us on Facebook and Twitter. You can find us at The Frame. I'm John Horn. Thanks for listening. We'll see you back here tomorrow.